Well, sorry, kind of an abrupt ending there for the first hour, but we just flat out ran out of time. Ghost Adventures to be heard Friday nights, seen Friday nights on Travel Channel. I'm big on Travel Channel. I think it'd be fun to see a mashup on Travel Channel with Andrew Zimmern, my friend Andrew Zimmern, who, of course, eats bizarre foods all over the world, and the Ghost Adventurers. Wouldn't that be fun? Have Andrew come on one of these ghost adventure travels and eat the ghosts? Or, for that matter, too, look for Bravo's Real Dead Housewives. That's probably coming soon, too. Those are the perfect guys to do it. Coming up, Peter Lavenda is also tracking sinister forces, but of a different nature. Instead of taking, you know, camera and audio recording equipment into haunted places, he's looking for the sinister forces that are hiding in plain sight, who are evidenced in our history. The practitioners of political witchcraft. We'll talk about these sinister forces, this three-part series, a grimoire of American political witchcraft. How is it that our country has this tradition of political witchcraft? What does it mean and how does it affect you? You have to know this. Coming up next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. I love reading whatever Peter Lavenda writes, and I've been reading his stuff for a very long time. I like having all three books now in my possession. Sinister Forces, book 1, 2, and 3. Good evening, Peter Lavenda.
Good evening. Thank you for having me on.
And I'll also say this, although, okay, you don't have to say it, but also, I believe, the author of the Necronomicon, which just happens to also be a very good book, but I realize you'll continue to say that you didn't write that, but I think you did. And so whether it's Simon or Peter, I really do. I enjoy your work quite a bit. And I found what you did here with Sinister Forces to be a very bold claim, but, you know, no shortage of footnotes and lots of documentation to make your claim that we have been the victims of political witchcraft. How do you define that, Peter?
Well, political witchcraft to me is the real mechanisms of how American political life is structured. I mean, we grow up in this country believing that politics is a kind of science. You know, there's a cause and effect relationship. People vote. People come into power. They make the trains run on time, or they dig ditches to build canals or dams or roads and things like that. But there's something more to it. There's something a lot deeper to it. There's power involved in politics, and it's a very different kind of power than most people ever have a chance to experience in their lives. It's the power over other people and the power over resources. So I think that what happens is it becomes very close to a kind of witchcraft. I mean, the politicians use a lot of the same concepts, whether consciously or unconsciously. You know, they're, in a sense, when they're talking to you and when they're trying to arrange their agendas, there's the use of charisma. There's the use of persuasion. The kind of propaganda stuff that, in fact, that our marketing people learned during World War II, you know, to use against the enemy, have been turned against us. So I think that when we talk about political witchcraft, we're talking about some of the very strange stuff that goes on behind the scenes, where we think all is, you know, Mr. Smith goes to Washington, but it's really a lot darker than that, a lot more devious. There's a lot more very strangely motivated people in politics. Their motivations, I think, would shock us if we really understood what they were.
Well, we'll talk about that more. We'll pull that curtain back as you see it here coming up. But you say we would be shocked if we knew the extent of it. I think the part that I enjoyed so much here about book one, and by the way, I'm kind of torn. I don't know whether to do a survey of all three books or just to break this interview up over three separate interviews over time and do book one, book two, and book three. I really don't know what to do because it's you cover a lot of ground and we can't possibly get to all of it in one interview. And Matt, I don't even know in the end whether we could get to all of it if we did three interviews. So I think maybe just one great one will do. But it may be that we have to bring you back again in the future, because you go back so far into our nation's history. You look at it before we were organized as the United States of America, and you think the seeds for this political witchcraft has been with us even before there was an us.
Yes, definitely. I think one of the concepts I use in Sinister Forces is to speak of America as a kind of haunted house. You know, you just had, you know, some guys talking about that just before we started talking. And as a matter of fact, the Bobby Mackey Club is in Sinister Forces. I talk about that in one chapter. That made a big impression on me as well. But I think that the country as a whole is a haunted house. We tend to forget that there were people living here. There were entire civilizations here that we've built our cities over and on top of. And I talk about the Indian burial mounds as being the first step towards understanding that.
Right. Well, I want to amplify that. So kind of like how in the movie Poltergeist, it all comes down to this new, beautiful subdivision that everybody's going to be finding their ultimate happiness in. And then they find out that internally it's infected because they had done something sinister in the way in which they were presenting this paradise. They essentially just paved over an Indian burial ground, and that it took a very short time for the truth and the pain of that to be revealed in paradise.
Exactly. I think it's an excellent metaphor for my view of what's happened to American history. You can take that film and expand on it, you know, but that's basically the theme that I see. I see that we were colonized, the country was colonized, by people who were religious refugees. You know, we also tend to forget that. We kind of think, well, they were fleeing some kind of, bad situation, and they came here to make their fortune. But these were religious people with very strict religious understandings, whether it was Catholic forces from Spain moving into the southern part of the country and into Latin America, or it was Puritans going into, you know, New England. These are people with very, very strict religious beliefs. And now they confront an essentially pagan civilization, whether it's the Indian burial mounds that they come across. And some of these mounds were extremely elaborate. These were not just hills. I mean, they were very like the Serpent Mound in Ohio and things of that nature. These were astronomically oriented mounds. Some of them are vast, larger than the pyramids in terms of mass. So they confront that. They confront the Indians themselves, the Native Americans, whom Cotton Mather and his father thought were actually demons, you know, from their point of view, since they were not mentioned in the Bible. Right. They were not human, you know, so...
Which is out of their ignorance.
And
so in a way, whether it's Cotton Mather or Columbus, everybody from Europe that was coming over was really good at the idea of confronting the things that they encountered, but pretty bad at confronting themselves. And instead of looking deeper into themselves to think, you know, if you'll pardon me, but in the case of the Puritans, or even in Columbus's case, we talk about them being people of faith. But it didn't take long for people of faith to resort to murder and enslavement, because there was a justification that what was right for them was all that they needed in order to justify what we look back on history now with a certain perspective and think those are some pretty horrific acts.
Certainly, you know, and there was no reason for us to become introspective. There was so much land to conquer, you know, the manifest destiny idea and go west, young man, you know, just keep moving forward. Don't stop. Don't think. Don't try to understand what you're doing, why you're doing it. You know, don't look at inner motivation at all. Just keep going forward. You're going to find enemies, kill them. You know, you're going to find land, take it. Keep going till you hit the Pacific Ocean. So we as a nation, and I'm not trying to cast aspersions on us as Americans, you know, we didn't really have much choice in the matter once this whole thing started rolling. But once it happened, we found ourselves in really an alien country, in an alien land that had been populated by vast numbers of people. We had tremendous earthworks. We had, of course, all of the Aztec and Mayan and Inca buildings in South America. There were people here. There was a vast civilization, and we paved it over, basically, like in Poltergeist.
Right. And that's the framework, again, for we're talking with Peter Lavenda, Sinister Forces, a grimoire of American political witchcraft. And what we're doing here is laying the foundation, to extend the metaphor a little further, into what Peter means by political witchcraft and how we're still affected by it. As these, you know, whether it was in South America, the Caribbean, North America, the people that were coming in were making moral compromises in order to achieve greater good goals. Fair to say?
Yes, I would agree with that. Yeah.
And in doing so, they establish a pattern of looking outward instead of inward. And that looking outward piece, we see that lived out, I think, right away in the Salem witch trials. Easier to point the finger at somebody else to blame for your problems than to look at what you have been doing. And so then we end up with things like the Salem witch trials, which we know resulted in, you know, in dozens of innocent deaths.
Yes. And it was sort of setting the stage for what would happen in succeeding generations. I mean, we had a scapegoat. You know, we had a series of scapegoats. We started with a slave woman who was bought in the Caribbean and taken up to Salem. She was an Arawak Indian, which is very ironic, because when Columbus first so-called discovered America, the Indians that he encountered were Arawaks, most of whom got decimated eventually. But what happened was he encountered Arawaks in 1492, and almost exactly 200 years later, there's an Arawakian Indian in Salem who is, you know, instigating unconsciously, not deliberately, but instigating the whole Salem witchcraft hysteria. And then, you know, she's the scapegoat. All of these young girls go, you know, hysterical. They start pointing fingers at each other. They start using what they call ephemeral evidence, which means invisible evidence, and accusing almost everybody in town eventually. But the whole thing was like the revenge of the Arawaks, you know. Suddenly we have all of these white people, Puritans in Salem, pointing fingers at each other and having themselves arrested.
Right, walking around and killing each other.
Well, and to complete the irony, the Indian woman, the Native American woman, the Arawakian Indian, who was considered the cause of this, was actually released from prison eventually and sort of disappeared. We don't know what happened to her. So she came on the scene, you know, taught some kind of rudimentary magic spells, evidently. And one thing we do tend to forget is that witchcraft was being practiced in that area. I mean, historians now and scholars now have come to the conclusion that, yes, there was an element of occultism, because New England was rife with occultism. It was rife with magic. It was filled with Rosicrucians and people of that nature. I mean, the governor of Connecticut in the 17th century, Winthrop, I believe his name was, had a vast collection of works on occultism, alchemy, magic, and that sort of thing.
Yeah,
so this
I think
went very high, you know.
Yeah, I think this is also what's very interesting about how the Salem witch trials end up being kind of a blueprint for a pattern that we repeat throughout our history, and that when we, if you look back on the, if the average person were to reflect back on the Salem witch trials, they would think about simple people, unsophisticated intellects, folks that were susceptible to outrageous claims restricted by their religious beliefs. But you pull back the lens a little bit and show that, just like you mentioned, plenty of people there were not only interested intellectually in the occult, but were practicing it even while they were still living in this puritanical society. They weren't practicing witchcraft necessarily, but they were practicing a kind of what we call the Christian Kabbalah.
Yes.
Explain that. How would that have gotten lived back then during the Salem witch trials?
Well, it was interesting because Christian Kabbalah has its origins in the 15th century and in the 16th century in Italy, for the most part, when the first books of the Kabbalah were being translated into Latin. And it became a kind of way to prove what was happening in the New Testament by using Kabbalah, the Kabbalistic methods of the Jews, and using their systems to reinterpret the New Testament and to prove that Jesus was actually the Messiah. So the Christian Kabbalah was using Kabbalistic methods, Jewish mystical methods, to prove the veracity, the truth of the New Testament. So this eventually turned into a more elaborate program where Kabbalistic methods, Christian Kabbalistic methods, could be used to invoke spirits, could be used to see the future, to divine things, to attain some kind of communion with the divine. So all of this was being used in a kind of religious context that was considered kind of elitist and kind of sophisticated. It wasn't the kind of folk magic that it's always been portrayed by the older academics and scholars. They've now come to realize this was a sophisticated thing.
Well, Christian...
Saying, well, we're not stupid, you know?
Yeah, Christian mysticism, for people who are unfamiliar with it, there is a long tradition of Christian mysticism, goes back to the very earliest formation of the Christian church, but it's also been something which has been considered, if not a heretical, at least something which was frowned upon by the Orthodoxy, who saw religious experience as something that was much more regimented, and mysticism defies that kind of liturgical regimentation. And so there's kind of this uneasy relationship with that tradition. And then when the Christian Kabbalah comes along, it kind of explodes a little bit, becomes a much more on a kind of a common person experience, especially, as you mentioned, because of the Rosicrucians and some of these other secret societies that were practicing this kind of universalism, this kind of Christian view that was less about saving people by condemning them, by punishing them.
Right. Some of the most famous of our founding fathers had connections back to this movement. In near Philadelphia, towards the end of the 17th century, just shortly before our revolution, there was a group of Rosicrucians from Germany living in a small community outside of Philadelphia. And these were people who believed the world was going to end soon. They were Christian Kabbalists. They had Rosicrucian ties and Rosicrucian background. And they were passionate about what they were doing. People from the neighboring villages and towns would go to them for healing, for all sorts of other assistance, but they kept mostly to themselves. And actually, Ben Franklin became friendly with one of the groups that grew out of this movement near Philadelphia. He was familiar with them. This was a very strong, powerful movement. It was Rosicrucian for the most part, and it was, you know, Rosicrucianism is a form of Christian mysticism. For listeners who don't know where that fits in, but the Rosicrucian movement started around 1618 in Europe. As part of the Protestant Reformation, you might say, and it grew out of that. It became a very strong movement on its own, and it attracted intellectuals, mystics from all different walks of life, including very religious people.
So when does something like that become how you describe a sinister force?
Well, there is a problem. There's a problem with the esoteric in general. There is a built-in kind of a problem that everyone should always be aware of, and that is there's a temptation to be God. When you have secret knowledge, when you know things other people don't, when you believe that you understand the workings of the world and no one else does, there is a tendency to have your ego inflated to the point of near explosion, and you suddenly feel that you have a right to tell other people what to do. You're an elitist. You become arrogant in your knowledge, you know. And in some cases, this type of knowledge is abased. It is abused. I mean, the context of Faust, for instance. You know, here we have this perfect example of an intellectual guy, someone who now is emotionally distraught for various reasons and begins to commit himself to a complete study of the occult, to Kabbalah, to magic, to mysticism.
Right.
and then the devil shows up, you know.
And it's these deals we make with the devil then. We'll play this out coming up next. Peter Lavenda, Sinister Forces, A Grimoire of American Political Witchcraft. We'll keep exploring that idea of political witchcraft, all the different ways in which Peter Lavenda believes this dark side of occultish beliefs have influenced American history and continue to control us today on Coast to Coast. So we're talking with Peter Lavenda again. Nice to have him back on. Sinister Forces. He calls it a grimoire of American political witchcraft, how these forces have always been at work, how it works on several different levels, too. And we'll get back to that conversation that he was honing in on from the first hour. We had Nick and Zach on from Ghost Adventures on the Travel Channel. And they've spent a lot of time at this place called Bobby Mackey's Music World in Kentucky. And Peter Lavenda actually talks a lot about Kentucky in this one particular part of Kentucky, which he sees as a very interesting nexus to political witchcraft. Things that you would never expect to get tied down to one geographic location, but do. And what an unlikely place for it to have been happening. But he sees it as something bigger than just a coincidence. And then we'll talk about this repetition of history, of political witchcraft, all the way through World War II, the Nazi connection, and through today, coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Peter Lavenda is the author of Unholy Alliance, A History of Nazi Involvement with the Occult, one of his many books that we've talked to him about here on Coast to Coast. Sinister Forces is out in three parts. And so that means that Peter Lavenda has been writing this book, this encyclopedia, as it were, for a very long time. 25 years of research and 25 years of you driving around in cars of various quality. Looking at these firsthand, right? I got a kick out of hearing you talk about the car you're driving at that time. So we were talking about the Salem witch trials and how they were kind of a blueprint, kind of a repetition of what would happen then throughout American history, even, you know, prehistory, before there's the United States. There was this habit we had of using witch trials and one aspect of it. And then the other aspect of it is using the occult and people in power who were whose perspectives on the world were influenced by the occult in positive ways, but also very much in negative ways, too. So let's move the story, the timeline up to the founding fathers. What evidence do we see of occultish practices with the founding fathers?
Well, it depends what you want to call occultish. If you're going to talk about Freemasonry, for example, we have, you know, a lot of evidence where that's concerned. We're waist deep in it, I think. Of course, Ben Franklin being a Freemason and Washington being a Freemason and, you know, on and on and on. And Franklin was really quite a hellraiser on his own. I mean, he joined not only the Masonic Society in the United States, he was a member of the Masonic Lodge in France. He introduced Voltaire and got him initiated into Freemasonry. But he was also involved with the Hellfire Club, in England, which was a group of people who sort of practiced black masses as a gesture of defiance against authority, both religious and secular. Franklin was a hanger-on at some of those events. There was a lot of underground secret societies taking place. I mean, our country was basically founded by people who believed in some of the same principles. The European Enlightenment was part and parcel of what it meant to be a Freemason in those days.
Well, that's true. But what was the influence then, both positively and negatively, from the occult in the actual, you know, formalization of the United States?
Well, that's it. That you're talking really about where the nexus is, because with something like Freemasonry, let's use Freemasonry as an example, not to bash on them, but let's just take Freemasonry as an example. You have a brotherhood gathering for ostensibly very good, high moral purposes. However, they meet in secret, and they have bizarre ceremonies involving death and resurrection. Now, if you talk to Freemasons, they'll say, we're just teaching morals, we're teaching a community, we're teaching brotherhood and all of these things. We are not a separate religion. And then I asked them, I said, but, you know, what you're doing basically is saying that religion is not offering these things. I mean, your very existence is a critique of religion. You're saying religion is not going to give you the sense of brotherhood. It's not going to teach you morality. It's not going to teach you any of these things. No wonder the church hates you. I mean, you've set yourself up as an anti-church. Not only that, but you're initiating people into various degrees. So when this happens, when you have this kind of secrecy, and when you have this idea of we have secret handshakes, and something happens to us during the initiatory process that cannot be explained and we cannot discuss it with other people, you are creating an anti-community. You know, whether your intentions are the best in the world, it doesn't matter. You've set up an us versus them situation. And
okay.
Freemasonry, of course, only would invite people that they wanted to join their club. It wasn't just send in an application fee, $5 and a box top, and you can be a Freemason. It didn't work that way. So it was a men's club, and it was an elitist men's club.
And so your claim right away is kind of in the history of the United States, that anytime you get a situation where you have elites who are self-impressed with their knowledge and the way in which they can share that knowledge, the kind of fraternal organizations that existed, that anytime you have that, then the dark side is that people start to practice a kind of specialness, and that the effect is that we have a sort of stratas within our society, people who are in, people who are out, haves and have-nots, and that this pattern also is part of the formation of the United States.
Well, sure. I mean, once you have a group of people who believe that they possess certain secrets that the rest of us don't, whether it's Freemasons or whether it's an intelligence agency, you have the same kind of mentality. You can take an intelligence agency, an agent from an intelligence agency, and they're virtually a Freemason because they have a name, which is a false name, which mm-hmm. Freemasons will take. They have a false name. They've gone through an initiatory process. They believe they have special information that no one else has, special abilities that other people don't have, and it creates an us and them situation. You have removed yourself from the community. You've removed yourself from the society, and now you're, in a sense, lording it over that society.
Special information gives you special rights.
Special rights and special powers, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So what happens then? You'll have the occult. So now if you want to defend yourself, essentially, against this, if the Freemasonry is out there as an example, secret societies in general are out there, there are high levels of government that have secrets, and you're an individual person, you're just an average person, the occult can suddenly take on a great deal of attraction. Because it looks as though if you would practice these rituals, if you would get involved in occultism this way, it enables you to get on a kind of an equal footing with the boys' club, right? Because now you're going to sort of storm the gates of heaven. You're going to try to find out this information on your own without the benefit of, a vast support system of a secret
right.
society. So you're instigating occultism by creating a Masonic society with all the weirdness, around it. With all the secrets and all the, you cannot speak this or throw out your tongue and burn your ashes and all the rest of it. You have all of that. You've created this mystique of power, this mystique of specialness. So there's going to be a reaction. And in our history, of course, there was. There was a violent reaction against Freemasonry in the early 19th century.
Right.
There was an anti-Masonic society, out of which basically the Republican Party grew.
Right. So. And there was a feeling that the Freemasons had overplayed their hand. They were truly, for what was a secret society, they were publicly lording it over the rest of the culture.
Yes. I mean, the governor of New York at the time of the William Morgan affair, which was the early days of the 19th century, was a Freemason. He was giving jobs to other Freemasons. You know, so it was a crony system that was set up.
Right.
So suddenly political power, financial power, all of this was being wrapped up into this boys club again, into this secret society. So there was an obvious major reaction against it during the William Morgan affair. William Morgan was the guy who was going to publish the rituals. He was going to publish the Masonic secrets, and he was told not to. He wouldn't listen. He was arrested on some petty charge. Freemasons went and broke him out of jail and kidnapped him, and he was never heard from again.
Right.
This was an outcry. This sponsored the start of the whole anti-Masonic hysteria in the United States.
But what you're doing isn't, and I just want to make clear about this, in your book, Sinister Forces, this is not an anti-Masonic book. You're just trying to show how these different currents or undercurrents were kind of all flowing at the same time. And it isn't just this one. So I don't want to get too focused on the Masonic aspect of it. But let's talk about some of the other undercurrents. Let's talk about some of the really – I mean, would you say there was a satanic undercurrent in the United States from its earliest formation?
Well, the United States, people have to remember why or how this whole United States thing started. And we're talking about Columbus in 1492. And, you know, he's looking for, as we're taught in school, he's looking for a different way to get to India, right? We're never really told the whole story. I mean, I wasn't when I was in school. And it took me until I was writing Sinister Forces, and I got a copy of Columbus's own diary, which was published in English and Italian translation or Spanish translation, that you're able to go and really realize what was motivating Columbus. And what motivated him, what motivated the discovery of America, was that Columbus wanted to find a way to finance the next crusade against Islam. Columbus was telling King Ferdinand that he was going to find a way to get to India, get all this gold, so that Ferdinand, who had already started fighting, getting rid of the last caliphs in Spain, was going to mount now a crusade really against Jerusalem. This is in 1492. It's way after the last crusade had been fought. But Ferdinand, because he got, you know, happy and arrogant because he had kicked out the last remaining Muslims out of Spain, now wanted to go and mount this major expedition. So this evidence is there in Columbus's own diaries. I'm going to help you raise the money. We're going to go and, you know, go on our next crusade, liberate the Holy Land. So the motivation for Columbus was, number one, to find money to finance a crusade. But number two, if he could find India going in the direction he was going, that meant he could possibly mount an expedition to attack Jerusalem, to attack the Holy Land from the east instead of from the west. In other words, instead of coming across the Mediterranean or through Europe the way all the crusades had been, he was going to find a different way to go, you know, and somehow they were going to be able to mount a campaign and attack it. It's like the movie Lawrence of Arabia, where Lawrence says, "We're going to attack Aqaba from the desert side. No one's expecting us. They can't turn their guns around." It was the same kind of concept with Columbus and Ferdinand. So here is the religious motivation. It was a holy war that motivated this dramatic accident of suddenly Columbus finding himself in Santo Domingo in 1492, you know, and meeting the Arawaks and thinking that they were from India. You know, all of this was taking place, and, you know, Columbus thought he had succeeded. And the idea was to finance a religious war. So it started that way. You know, the European, you know, experience in North America started on that basis. And then we had waves of religious refugees coming in. Religion was always part of this country, one way or the other. And it was all the religions that could not survive, you know, in Europe came right to North America and set up their operations over, you know, the graves of civilizations they did not even know existed.
Right, you know, didn't care. Trampling on things that they didn't even know were there. So I'm gonna challenge you then on this idea, because it goes back to what you're talking about before about the Salem witch trials, or for other people, the way for good folk who were intellectually dissatisfied with the status quo, who were, you know, forced into a regimented society of an orthodoxy with which they could not comport, that those people sometimes fell into occultish practices, if nothing else, as you mentioned about Ben Franklin, as a way of kind of thumbing their nose at authority. And that from the very beginning, this is part of the United States. And you said that even the Republican Party, you could say, was a reaction to the Masonic power, the centralized power of Freemasonry in the United States. But then there was this other part, though, like Abraham Lincoln is very clear about this in his writings leading up to the Civil War, that he believed it was the obligation of the United States to get rid of the stain of slavery, that this was that slavery was going to prevent us from getting God's grace, that God would not shed God's grace on the United States as long as we were still practicing slavery, and that was the undergirding to a lot of the theology behind the Civil War. Wouldn't you agree with that?
Yes. Our country has always been embroiled in religious conflict. I mean, even when we're not really aware of it or conscious of it, there's a religious undercurrent to things that are taking place. And where Lincoln was concerned, I agree 100%. He saw this as a spiritual matter. You know,
and he thought it was good versus evil. He thought that evil was slavery, and that this evilness was what was institutionalized, that this country was heading down a further dark path of practicing the subjugation of one group over another. And he wanted to level the playing field. He wanted to get rid of that because he thought God would never favor the United States and we would be ruined for generations. The whole future of the country didn't just depend on keeping the states together, but it also depended on getting rid of this abomination in the eyes of God, he believed, by getting rid of the evilness of slavery.
Exactly. And if we could only have held on to that concept just a little while longer, another 100 years or so or less, because during World War II, the next big stain, the next big danger for the United States was the fact that we got into bed with the Third Reich, with the Nazis, and that even after the war was over, we brought so many of their scientists and so much of their spies, their intelligence officers and everything else into the bosom of our country. We made a pact with the devil then, because we thought that the Soviet Union was a more dangerous enemy, and the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and so we made a deal with the devil again. If we had had an Abraham Lincoln at the time to say, this is going to take us down a dark road, we can't do this. And there were people in government who said we couldn't. Even Harry Truman forbade the Pentagon from doing this, and they basically ignored him.
Yeah.
So, we did it again, in other words. So we stopped slavery, I mean, for what it was worth, because it took another 100 years, for African-Americans to get any kind of equality. But at least we abolished it, and we fought a war over it. And then now we're confronting Nazi Germany in the 1940s, another kind of slave master, machine in Europe. We defeat them, and then we bring them over to our side. So this, there was a danger again,
And this danger comes to us. The repetition of history is whenever we start to think we are like God, that we are gods, that we have this secret knowledge, and the secret knowledge becomes self-justifying. Whatever actions we take, other people, even if they don't know why we're doing it, they have to accept it because we know more than they do. That whether it's the CIA or whether it's the institution of slavery or whether it's the excesses of Freemasonry, that we have the repetition in our history of people in power that get distracted by the real meaning of what the country is supposed to be about, and instead take us down these keep making these deals with the devil in order to satisfy themselves. Yes?
Yes. And what happens when you make a deal with the devil is you have to lose your soul. I mean, this is a danger that we constantly face as a country,
right?
Losing our soul, losing who we are, losing our identity, because of these deals with the devil we constantly make.
Yeah. And that this is part of Sinister Forces, a grimoire of American political witchcraft, We're talking with Peter Lavenda. Got a lot more to get to before we get to your calls. I can't do this book. I can't even do book one justice, and there are three of them. But I think you're getting a good idea in broad brushes of what we're talking about and what it means. If you, you know, if you dance with the devil, you're going to get dipped. You know, I've always said, and you just got to accept that. So you don't, you want to avoid that. You take any bad time of the United States and you look just before that bad time and you'll see a time when we were making a deal with the devil, that, that our bad times always follow these compromises that we make on what the American experience is supposed to be about. So how does that constitute political witchcraft? Well, we'll get back to that coming up with Peter Lavenda. It's a very interesting concept and one which, again, we're just barely touching the surface. But there are a couple examples, and that will bring us back to Bobby Mackey's Music World in Kentucky on the way next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett.